candidates, welcome. Vice President Biden, the first question is for you. In the last few days, you've been saying that Democrats will be taking too big a risk if they nominate Senator Sanders or Mayor Buttigieg. But they came out on top in Iowa. What risk did the Iowa Democrats miss?
Well, they didn't miss anything. This is a long race. I took a hit in Iowa, and I'll probably take a hit here. Traditionally, Bernie won by 20 points last time, and usually it's the neighboring senators that do well. But I'm no matter what, I'm still in this for the same reason.
God love ya. That was Joe Biden making his closing bid to voters Friday at the latest Democratic presidential debate in New Hampshire, a state where the former vice president was leading in the polls as recently as 3 weeks ago, but tomorrow night might finish as low as fifth. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by my esteemed colleagues, Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy New Hampshire Eve, everybody.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
So we're going to talk about the Biden death march, plus some news you might have missed this past week. But first, who wants another libertarian podcast? You want another libertarian podcast, and it is called Lions of Liberty. Let me briefly tell you about it. They've got three weekly shows under that one umbrella feed over at lionsofliberty.com. There is the eponymous Monday flagship program, featuring guests such as Ron Paul, Gene Epstein, and our own beloved Nick Gillespie. Wednesday, they have Electric Liberty Land, a comedic breakdown of culture and current events. And then there's Felony Friday, where you get inspiring firsthand tales about people battling the criminal injustice system. Go to lionsliberty.com or your favorite podcasting platform. You'll be glad you did. Okay. What a absolutely terrible week for the Democratic Party. The Iowa caucus caucused up their vote tabulations pretty terribly, and even though the turnout wasn't particularly high, in the end, Bernie Sanders basically won the popular vote, Pete Buttigieg won the delegate vote, and Joe Biden finished fourth, just a tick ahead of Amy Klobuchar. While those recriminations were still ongoing, President Donald Trump gave a pretty effective State of the Union address Tuesday night, in which he didn't even reference impeachment. Speaking of which, on Wednesday, the president was formally acquitted along party lines, with the sole exception of Mitt Romney, who voted to convict on one count. Then Trump spiked the football in a bizarre victory ramble from the White House, and kind of began firing everyone who testified against him. Democrats now are increasingly face a choice between a Democratic socialist who honeymooned in the Soviet Union, a McKinsey-manufactured child politician bot who progressives despise, and a billionaire stop-and-frisker who they hate even more. Nick, you hate Joe Biden more than life itself. Is it possible that after seven times of doing this, he's just not very good at running for president?
Yeah, I think that's coming through pretty loud and clear. And unlike fine wine, he is really getting worse with age. His cork, he's been corked, Matt. The unwillingness for him to even engage Stephanopoulos's question in the bit that you ran, I think, is really telling. And it's telling in two possible ways. One, he doesn't want to actually come out swinging against Bernie and Pete Buttigieg or any of his opponents in clear, resounding terms. Like, he should have answered, vibrantly and explained exactly what he meant, which is, would be a good message, or that he didn't understand the question and that he needs like 15 minutes of, kind of preamp time to figure out what the hell he's going to say about anything, because there's so many birds' nests like corked in his brain somewhere.
I don't know if you guys saw Saturday Night Live this weekend, but their cold open was the Democratic debate, and the funniest bit, although it's cruel, but there's humor for you. The moderator says, "Mr. Biden, you have 60 seconds." He goes, "What? The doctor said I had 6 to 8 months." Which is just brutal. Peter, you live in Washington. I saw some of you people out there high-fiving Biden for post-debate attack adding Pete Buttigieg for his life accomplishments as a politician, which included repaving some stones and putting up lights in the city. Isn't the whole like, "Hey, I've been in Washington for a half century" thing not the most particularly inspiring campaign message?
I think it is a problem for Joe Biden right now. He is not offering people an actual positive vision except not Bernie. And that has always been his pitch, is he is a return to normalcy, whatever that is. And in some, you know, we could argue whether he is a return to normalcy. We could argue that he's actually much more liberal than Obama, than Hillary Clinton. There's, you know, I think those are plausible, good arguments, even for various reasons. He's proposing many more taxes, more spending. But in some ways, he is a return to the Democratic establishment as we have known it for the last 30 or 40 years. And the problem is the Democratic establishment, as we have known it for the last 30 or 40 years, is not particularly popular.
Sucks.
It is bad for a lot of reasons that libertarians would think, but it's also not super popular amongst Democrats. And that's why you are seeing Democratic voters look for an alternative in somebody who is relatively young and untested, Mayor Pete, and in somebody who is known as an outsider critic of the party and who has been a consistent critic of the Democratic Party for basically his whole political career, and that is Bernie Sanders, of course. And so Biden is arguing that you should return to a thing that everyone in his own party, not quite everyone, but many, many people in his own party are trying to get away from.
Catherine, as our resident Pete Stan, how tingly did your leg get when he started over the weekend talking about deficits and Bernie's too pie in the sky with his socialisms and such?
Yeah, I want some credit for the fact that the only two politicians in this recent cycle that I have grudgingly said even moderately good things about have been Pete Buttigieg and Mitt Romney. And they had a good week, y'all. I mean, seriously, Mitt Romney out there not only voting his conscience in a way that I thought did him credit, but also really expertly planning the media rollout of that thing. And I know that some people took that as more evidence that he's bad, but I think it's mostly just evidence that he's like excruciatingly competent. And if I may speak for America briefly, excruciatingly competent has a certain appeal right now. Also, Mayor Pete out there, A, talking about legalizing all drugs on the debate stage and then following it up by saying, yes, I really meant all drugs. Now he's talking about debt. He's not a libertarian. He sucks. They all suck. Everyone sucks. But still, my two guys are not doing badly right now. I would like to think that they represent some kind of like future change movement, libertarian moment. They don't, but still not too bad.
However, Romney Buttigieg.
Romney Buttigieg 2020. What I do want to say, though, is that I can't believe we made it this far into this podcast already without just saying out loud the phrase that Joe Biden said out loud, which is to call someone a lying dog-faced pony soldier at an official event. We're talking about Biden as like return to normalcy. What is that?
That's pretty normal for Joe Biden.
But not for America.
I would have.
But Joe Biden has been America for decades.
Look,
in a lot of
anytime he doesn't sniff hair, it's a victory for America.
Dog-faced pony soldier.
So,
what?
I would have used that as the clip, Catherine. I feel your implied rebuke. However, former host of this very roundtable podcast, Andrew Heaton, who I muscled aside in a power grab, was there. And he tweeted out, which I retweeted as well, that people are taking the quote out of context, that it was actually...
No, and I get it.
He was talking about his D&D class.
That he just meant it like, you rascal. Like, he meant it in a way that actually was just kind of like, you, hey, buckaroo, I'm coming for you. It's still cray.
It's so cray. What's up, Corn Pop? Nick, you referenced at the top, and I want to pursue this, kind of Biden's unwillingness to go after Bernie. In fact, they even had a huggy moment. There's been a lot of commentary that I am intrigued by, which is that basically what Democrats are doing and have been doing up until this moment in the 2020 Democratic primary mirrors what Republicans were doing and not doing with the rise of Trump in 2015 and 2016, which is to say, instead of attacking the weird interloper, they are terrified of his following and followers and sort of like keep a gloves off situation. And before you know it, it's kind of too late. What is your analysis of that? And then, you know, maybe like even their own outsider status on what that might say about the parties. How do you take that comp?
Well, first off, I mean, let's stop with the fiction that Bernie is an outsider. He's been in Congress in one role or another for 25, 30 years.
Just outsider to the party, not at all.
Yeah, I know, but and he's run for president. I mean, that would be like saying Jesse Jackson is an outsider because he never wins the nomination or something like that. I think it's really central to Bernie to be like, oh, look at me, I'm such an outsider that I'm at fucking every Democratic Party thing that's been going on forever. And having said that, going back to something that Peter touched on, I think it's really interesting and exciting to see non-establishment type characters like a Hillary Clinton, like a Joe Biden sailing to easy victory. I mean, Hillary obviously got the nomination through hook and crook in 2016, but Biden is being bloced here. And I think it's pretty compelling. You know, he has a whole story he's going to tell about South Carolina and Super Tuesday and all of that. That may come true, but he has to do the equivalent of whatever somebody does after they've had as much plastic surgery as he has to sweat. To the nomination. But in 2016, in that campaign, Trump destroyed the Republican Party or the Republican establishment. To a point where loyal Republicans were even taking somebody like Rand Paul as like the person they wanted over somebody like Donald Trump because Trump is too much of an outsider. You know, I think we're seeing that in the Democratic Party. And for me, that gives me hope. Not because Bernie is better than Biden or Biden is better than Trump or anything like that. I don't think that's actually true, and I don't think it's meaningful. But when you see these major parties going through conniptions trying to maintain control over their own process, I think everybody wins. And that's the beginning of the end of the duopoly in the form that it has been locked into for about 50 years. So more power to all of this.
Peter, do you share Nick's enthusiasm for when scruffy outsiders take over the weak hosts of political parties? Or are you a Jonathan Rauch institutionalist?
I think there's some good things and some bad things. It is a useful demonstration of the weakness and the awfulness of the duopoly and the two-party system when Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump end up being the nominees. And I think Nick's totally right that when you see that happening, that is a sign of the collapse of those institutions, and it is a sign that people are figuring out that they don't work and they don't provide what people want from them. However, I also think that it's kind of a bad situation when we end up with the legacy of that duopoly still in place, because the institutions we have are designed around the expectation that there will really only be two political parties that matter, and that each one of them will produce a presidential nominee, and that they will also vie for power in Congress in the two chambers, and that then what you end up with are extreme candidates who, like Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders, if he is the nominee, you have to presume that even if you think that Trump is more likely to win, he has a reasonably good chance at winning the presidency. He is at worst the second most likely person to be president, you know, starting in January of 2021. And I don't want Bernie Sanders to be president. I think that someone like Bernie Sanders is dangerous. And similarly, I think that Donald Trump remains quite dangerous as someone who holds more political power than certainly any other person in this country, arguably any person in this world. And so when you have a system that where the duopoly is kind of hanging on there and we're still forced to play by its rules in many ways, but it is producing bad results, then you get this kind of institutional breakdown that leads to a decline in trust. Nick has written about this. I think that's what you're seeing here with the nomination processes in the last couple of years. And that leads to bad governance, and it leads to large-scale social risk is maybe the way that I would put it, in that candidates like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, especially with the presidency, where you have so much power bound up in the discretion of one individual who often ignores the limitations on his or her power, there's just a huge amount of risk in nominating somebody who is just like the screw it, I hate everybody else, let's just try something crazy and different, mold. And that's what we're seeing. And I do worry about the long term potential risks that come with that.
Hey, Catherine, I was on our good pal Kennedy's show last week, and it's always fun to, in the green room, watch the displays of Fox Business and Fox. They were talking about two things. One is, you know, that damned rat bastard liberal sellout Mitt Romney. And then the other was this amazing amount of kind of gleeful crocodile tears over the way that the establishment is screwing over Bernie Sanders. It seems very obvious that Republicans and the president in particular love to cheer on Bernie at this point, whether they think it's because he is himself kind of a divisive figure or that he's beatable or whatnot. But all of this, plus the Iowa debacle and the recriminations that came after it, got me thinking, like it doesn't take much to rip the mask off the Democratic Party right now and realize how much they all hate each other. Like, imagine if it comes down to Bernie versus Bloomberg versus Mayor Pete. It might not be possible to unify a Democratic Party around that, no?
I mean, the idea that those three men are all in the same party is the strongest possible case you can make for we shouldn't only have two parties, right? Like, that's crazy. Those three people share only the thinnest of unifying agendas. The country that they envision, there are three totally different timelines. And the idea that we're going to sort of have to shove them all into the same box and then only one of them gets to come out a winner in the end is a total indictment of the system. I will say, like, I have been, like you, watching the kind of, to me, the most interesting conflict is the class warfare versus identity politics debate. But that's not really what those three guys are even. There are so many other rifts and divides inside the party that you can't, like...
Well, doesn't it seem like the class warfare folks basically won? That the identitarians, the strongest identitarians...
Well, not if Bloomberg is the nominee, right? I mean, you know, it's awfully hard to make the case, though, of course, this is something
though
that people keep pointing out.
Even he is talking about taxing rich people and the whole thing.
And the
strong identitarians, Matt's written this, the people who ran the campaigns that are most focused on identitarian issues have dwindled in this field.
Yeah. But I don't think that they are. I don't think you should count them out as a force within the party. I think that it so happens in this field right now. That's how it shook out. But like, identity politics still is the bread and butter of most of the kind of mid-tier Democratic activist pool. And, you know, that's why you see this desire to screw over Bernie. That's why you see all of these weird institutional tensions. But I do just want to kind of come back around also to this point about
it's Chapo Trap House versus Pod Save America all the way down.
God, wow, that's a dark vision. No, I wanted to come back around to the total shamelessness of the Romney is a leftist condemnation, because it really, like, the pure kind of post facto reasoning, like the rationalization of these positions after the fact, the instant turn against him. He would have been a hero if he had voted the other way. No one would ever would have said anything else. Also, Alan Dershowitz, do we want to take a minute and talk about what happened there?
What happened there?
So in Alan Dershowitz's testimony at the second or third to last day of the impeachment hearings, he sort of Dershowitzed. Like, he did this, like, thought experiment out loud in the middle of one of the most important, you know, moments maybe of his life, and sort of said, well, technically, if a hypothetical president believed that he was acting in the national interest by ensuring his own election, if you believed that being elected was a crucial part of securing the national interest, and if that motivation was mixed with other motivations, that would not itself be corrupt. Now, first of all, everyone interpreted it in a much less subtle way, just as, like, literally Dershowitz ratifies the Sun King, right? It was just like, oh, if you think your own election is good, let's hot say moi, like, we're done. But the fact that every single Democrat got up on their high horse and said, like, I can't believe that he would suggest that an executive could equate their own interests with the interests of the country. We would never do anything like that. And to even say that out loud is frankly ridiculous. Meanwhile, everyone does something like that every day.
Are you not enjoying, though, the way that both Mitt Romney and John Bolton, heroes of the Republican Party, first class,
absolutely,
have now become, like, it's like one of those things where the writer's room, it's like, we got to season 7. We never thought we'd get here. We didn't have enough story planned. And we're just like, well, I guess our lead characters are now bad guys.
I mean, just in general, just the sentence, Mitt Romney votes against one article of impeachment of Donald Trump. Like, that's a sentence already that 10 years ago. I mean, I know we keep saying this, but it really keeps being true. 10 years ago, that
Romney
sentence
is one of the least impressive people in American politics. I think, this, you know, whatever your partisan affiliation is, he was a terrible presidential candidate who had one good debate.
We know he was anti-immigration.
One good debate against Obama, and then pussed out in the subsequent conflicts with Obama. He was terrible. He would not even admit whether or not his law that Obamacare was drafted off of had an individual mandate. He wouldn't name a single program that he would cut if he were elected president. And then he's now doing the profile and courage thing where it's like he's in the most
I think he did want to cut funding
he
for
is
PBS.
The most,
it was like all 14. It was actually maybe just his personal donation to
he's
PBS.
The
he was going to cut the $20
a doing a profile and courage thing where it's like, oh, look at me. I'm standing up to the president who I lobbied for a job and whose ass I kissed. And he comes from a state that is resolutely anti-Trump. He's the safest politician in the world. He is spoiled milk all the way down. And it beggars my mind that anybody is taking any time to think about a guy who is as inconsequential as Mitt Romney.
I'm literally right here. I'm in the room with you, Nick, metaphorically. I mean, I just we've talked about this before, but I cannot disagree more. Like, that is a story you could tell about Mitt Romney. But another story you could tell, which I think is at least an equal contender for the truth, and the one that I find more compelling, is that he's a politician, again, and therefore has made compromises and has said things that are suboptimal and has, you know, kissed ass in various scenarios. But his story of he has a vision of the Republican Party. He tried to win the presidency with that vision. He failed. He went back into his corner and thought about what he could do that would still help make that vision a reality, even under Donald Trump. He is clearly an extremely competent and serious person. He clearly is like a principled guy who's thought deeply about these questions. I don't share all of his principles, and he sometimes has waffled on them, right? Again, he's a politician. But the idea that he is somehow particularly bad strikes me as wrong. He is better than average for a politician at the very least.
So I wrote a long feature on Mitt Romney when he was running in 2012 and spent a lot of time going through his record as Massachusetts governor. And I guess I kind of agree with both of you in that Mitt Romney was pretty bad on a lot of measures as a governor. Now, in some ways he was technocratically competent, but I think in ways that were largely negative and did not produce good policy, in particular with the Massachusetts predecessor to Obamacare. And then when he ran in this way that was weirdly sort of non-ideological and he didn't have really all that many political principles except the, you know, consulting world vision of let's just do stuff that works. And he didn't have a big idea for what American culture or politics should be. But at the same time, he was obviously incredibly accomplished in the private sector, somebody who was really a very good manager, thought deeply about how markets work, about how to add value, about labor, about all of this stuff. And he was also somebody who was just incredibly personally decent. And so I think that's what you're kind of seeing here, is that he's not a great politician in a lot of ways. He's not somebody who we want leading the country and sort of outlining a political vision for how the country should be governed. At the same time, he's somebody who has a kind of great, a real moral, personal decency and character that comes out in his politics and in the way he behaves himself as a U.S. senator.
Before we get off Mitt, just like to reiterate my ongoing analysis of those who are not on the left who criticize or oppose Trump. Always seem to come from three categories. It's the libertarians like Justin Amash. It's the neocons, or whatever they call themselves these days, the Bill Kristols of the world, of which none of the avatars in Congress have really opposed Trump in any meaningful sense. And it's the Mormons, some of whom have neoconish tendencies, some of whom have libertarian tendencies. But repeatedly, it always comes from those people. I wanted to also put a little number on the identity politics conversation. A random thing that I tracked from the moment that it happened was when Elizabeth Warren came out and leaked in an unfavorable way the conversation, the private conversation that she'd had with Bernie Sanders in December 2018, in which the allegation was that Sanders told her that a woman couldn't win the president. That day was January 13, when his lead over her in the national polls was, on average, weighted by 538, 2.4 percentage points. It is now, the last time I looked, which was yesterday, more than 8 percentage points. So like the identity politics Hail Mary that she threw did not make it to the end zone at all. Not even close. It was pretty remarkable. We're going to shift, I believe, to President Trump's post-impeachment victory lap in a moment. But first, one of our very favorite organizations in the world is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, who work their tails off to defend free speech on college campuses. You can read more about them at thefire.org or by texting the word FIRE to 52886. But first, let me tell you about three outrageous cases they helped defend. Naomi was barred by her campus from starting an animal rights club. Should have called Joaquin Phoenix, sister. Mike was blocked from proselytizing about legal pot. And Kevin was prevented from handing out copies of the actual Constitution. FIRE helped all three. You can read their full stories over at thefire.org or text the word FIRE to 52886. But here's the gist. FIRE's legal advocates successfully defended each student, vindicating, in the case of the Constitution kid, the free speech rights of more than 150,000 college students. Well done. FIRE does not care about your politics. It just wants students and faculty to be free in expressing them. Again, text FIRE to 52886 or visit thefire.org to discover more about their good works. You'll be glad you did. All right. 1 week into the life of the 45th president. On Monday, Trump wins the Iowa caucus 97% to 1% apiece for Bill Weld and Joe Walsh, the latter of whom eventually drops out. On Tuesday, Gallup's Presidential Approval Center register his highest ever approval rating of 49%, including 94% among Republicans. Then that night, he gives a comparatively restrained, if a bit on the reality TV style, State of the Union address, which is not at all subtle about going directly after the black vote. And if you listen to Van Jones, pretty successfully so. Wednesday, he gets acquitted. Thursday, he delivers just a bonkers ha-ha and ya-boo from the White House. Friday, he showily fires Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, mocks him obviously on Twitter, weirdly fires his twin brother, as well as EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland, transparently for testifying against him. Then he spends all weekend tweeting like a crazy person about like reinstating Pete Rose to the Hall of Fame and God knows what else. Today, he has unleashed, or his administration has, his annual and annually ignored budget proposal, and to top it off, hosting a town hall in New Hampshire tonight, and I am already exhausted just reading this very small selection of the president's activities for the last week. I'm just going to throw it out there to you people. What is one random impression that you get from the president of the United States performance and trials and tribulations of last week? Nick, you go first.
One is that it is totally his election to lose. He has a comparatively good record to run on in terms of economic growth and various other types of opportunities. And the one thing especially if he's running against Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren. You know, he's got an easy path to the basket, Matt, and all he has to do is keep his most awful tendencies under wraps, which is going to be very difficult for him, obviously. I think the pitch towards Black voters and to a lesser degree in some ads and things like that of Latino voters is actually more a bid for centrist white voters who are, you know, who are not going to be totally into any of the Democratic candidates, but also don't want to vote for somebody who is clearly a racist. And as a result, the way that he makes those plays and talks about the positive benefits of his presidency for minorities will make that a little bit easier. And I think that's a smart play, actually. And it might help peel off, you know, a couple of percentage points of ethnic and racial minorities that vote overwhelmingly in the other direction. So, I think what you're seeing here is a guy coming into some level of competency. Right at the right moment.
Suderman, what's one impression that you pull out of Trump's last 7 days?
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with Nick that the litany of things you described there is a sign of a president coming into competency. And also,
what are you going to vote against?
Just a little bit if it's 3.5 years into the presidency and he's finally becoming competent on the week that he delivers a bunch of crazy rants and fires his enemies.
Who cares about Vindman and all of that kind of stuff?
I care about firing
were you
going to
vote for Trump, Matt?
No, you asked who cares about that, and I said care about the president using the power of his office to punish his enemies. Go ahead, Suderman.
Yeah, so the actual thing that I wanted to point out was just the transparent hackishness of GOP centrists in the era of Trump, and in particular, Susan Collins, who, you know, explained her vote to acquit Trump by saying, you know, I do not believe that the House has met its burden, that the president's conduct, however flawed, warrants the extreme step of immediate removal from office. Decision is not whether you like or dislike this president or agree or oppose with or oppose his policies. It's about whether the charges meet the high constitutional standard of treason, bribery, high crimes, misdemeanors. Okay, fine. That's actually, I think I could come up with a disagreement with that. But I think that's completely fair, in fact, to vote to acquit on that. But she followed up by explaining, well, you know, I think Trump has learned his lesson. He's learned from this case, and that Trump will be much more cautious in the future and won't stop the kind of bad behavior that got all of this started. And then, of course, what does he go and do just a few days later this maniac rant from the White House and fires a bunch of people for political reasons, transparently, while pretending that that's not what he's actually doing. Exactly the stuff. And Collins leaks to the New York Times that she had warned the White House against doing this and that she was very disappointed. She knew Trump wasn't going to change. She had no reason to think that he had learned any sort of lesson. She gave this just completely hackish pretext for her vote because she wanted to vote with her party. And this, I think, is why it goes back to our Mitt Romney conversation. What Mitt Romney did, you can agree or disagree with it, but it was an actual act of political courage and bravery in certain ways, which is that he voted his personal conscience and did what a U.S. senator is supposed to do in an impeachment case, which is not to simply say, well, I am a pass-through for the poll numbers that we're getting out of my state. Instead, I'm here to exercise my own independent judgment.
He will face no reprisals for his vote. This is where I fail to see.
Wait. He has been disinvited from CPAC.
So he gets an extra weekend
off. That's a gift.
Hasn't attended since 2013 anyway.
And I don't mean to say everybody is a hack or anything, but it's like, he made the safest possible choice that he could do. It's like he pays no cost for this other than now that people are talking about, oh, Mitt Romney, what an honorable man. You know,
I think there's a difference between saying relative to other Republican senators, it was easier for Romney to make this choice and to say it was the safest possible choice he could do. Clearly, the safest possible choice for Romney was just to go along with the rest of his party and not say anything and just vote to acquit.
Not necessarily in Utah.
His state, Utah was not going to rebuke him for acquitting the president along with the entire rest of his party.
Mitt Romney is pretty much the king of Utah for life.
He's the king of Utah, but he's facing, even as we speak, bills in the Utah legislature, one that would allow voters the chance to directly recall the U.S. senator, their Utah senators, and another one that's an official censure of him. He had a lot of behind closed doors meetings and tongue waggings. It was not a pleasant week for Mitt Romney in Utah. I think it's worth pointing that out as well.
Again, like, he's not brave in the sense of like hiding Anne Frank in his attic brave, but like, you know, it was not, this was not the path of least resistance.
His houses are large.
And yeah, he has a lot of attics. And he has like 30 attics.
Case that, he could put a lot, the case that a lot of people. Democrats who voted to, you know, to cancel Donald Trump were voting out of principle. They were not also in lockstep with their parties. I mean, I fail to see how this is, you know, a moment to be like, oh, yes, finally. You know, we get something good out of a politician.
I'm not sure anyone's positing that necessarily. But Catherine, what's one takeaway that you have from President Donald Trump's last 7 days of activity?
There's so much room for activities. You know, I was just scrolling through his Twitter feed as we were talking, and I realized this is like the smallest small ball I could possibly offer you. But here's what I'm going to give you: a series of tweets just talking smack about Larry Sabato. Like, this is maybe actually good, I guess is what I'm saying.
Funny.
I'm looking for some Trump silver lining here. And here's what I've got is Larry Sabato is much better at giving you the answer after everything is finished and the final result is in than he is at telling you what's going to happen, because, in fact, he doesn't have a clue. Donald Trump is not wrong. That is the whole purpose of Larry Sabato, is that people are like, we need a quote from Larry Sabato that will say the conventional wisdom a bit after the fact, uncontroversially. And Larry Sabato is like, I have got you covered. And it's like, it's such a perfect example of Donald Trump as like a moderately astute viewer of cable news. Like, that's a good point, my guy.
Why do you guys think his approval rating is going up? I mean, is it just that, you know, more and more people are idiots? And again, I say this not as somebody.
Stop the throat clear. Jesus, you love him. Admit it.
I hope you're talking to somebody else, Matt. I'm just asking though, like, you know what you know. Everything is coming.
You're the most pro-Trump, anti-Trump guy I've ever met.
Yeah, no. I refuse to like wrap my personal feelings towards him and his policies, you know, into an analysis of whether is he more likely or less likely to win re-election as of today than as of
his State of the Union speech answers this question, which is that the economy is very good. And that is like both a sort of boring pundit thing, like Larry Sabato would say that kind of thing. And also, you know, Donald Trump led with a full 30 to 40 minutes of reminding people that the economy is very good. And that was a smart thing to do, because the economy is, in fact, quite good. And if we believe, as we have at least said that we believe as a country for a very long time, which is that the president has some sort of quasi-magical power to make the economy good, that he deserves credit and blame when the markets go up and down, then that's it. It's a very simple equation. Now, of course, I think all of us on this podcast know that it's more complicated than that. And in fact, Donald Trump has done many things that have been good for the economy, but also is waging a trade war that may take a dent out of the economy in the long run, and in fact may already be. You know, there are cyclical things that happen where the subsequent president benefits from the decisions of the previous president and vice versa. So I think it is generally wrong to equate a president's actions with the quality of the economy one to one. But the fact is, the economy is good and the Democrats are thinking about running it absolutely crazy socialist. Donald Trump looks okay to the electorate. That just seems like a very simple, obvious thing and does not require us to do any kind of like fake news, real America, class war. You know, we don't have to do any of that. It could just be people feel like things are okay at their house right now.
To answer your question, Nick, I think he's gone up recently because Democrats did impeachment bad. And there's a decent track record of when, you know, the impeachers seem to not do a very good job, the president accrues some benefit. I don't know if that, I wouldn't predict that that would stay because impeachment is now over, except in the mind of Tom Steyer and Maxine Waters and a few others. So we'll see if that lasts. And the other thing I would say to Catherine's point and the Larry Sabato perennial point is that traditionally there has been a connection between presidential approval ratings and the state of the economy. This has not been a traditional president. As Trump himself would point out, Larry Sabato cannot predict the future. The future, based on that usual prediction, starts to look a little dicey. Although, to argue against that point with myself, it's also true that the moment that the financial crisis really hit in 2008 was the death knell of the John McCain campaign. It was the single biggest factor in that election was that Barack Obama was seen as the person who could respond to that crisis well and not John McCain. So it can, if it goes bad.
But then Obama also beat Mitt Romney when everybody was saying, based on economic indicators, Obama was the most vulnerable incumbent in years.
So the tethering of economy and presidents is changing than it does normally. All right. There's been a lot of, and we've referenced a lot of crazy amounts of news that the dogs of the media are chasing squirrels of news over the past week. There's way too much news basically between the Super Bowl and the New Hampshire primary. It's an insane 10-day stretch of alcoholism. One thing that libertarians are fond of doing is pointing out other stuff and saying, see, that's important.
Is drinking?
Yes. But so I want each of us to go around and point at some bit of news that is of importance that has happened since last we convened together. Catherine, why don't you go first?
I also am going small on this one, but I think a particularly good outrage bit of news, which is Baltimore County just casually admitting that it hasn't been recycling the glass that it's collected for 7 years.
Oh.
So, like, this is.
But hey, folks, make sure to recycle.
Yeah. So this is the kind of thing that is, you know, if it weren't true, it would sound like a crazy thing that like John Tierney made up when he was high, because it's such a dent out of the orthodoxy of recycling specifically and also just symbolic environmental acts. Baltimore County, again, collecting glass in single stream recycling. So everyone's just dumping it into their bins. Turns out that's a terrible way to recycle glass. It gets dirty. It's not usable. They've been chucking it for 7 years. And when asked, hey, do you think maybe you could tell people to stop putting glass in the recycling? County officials explicitly say, well, we don't want people to get out of the habit of doing the ritual of recycling, because maybe someday we will figure out once again how to make the recycling of filthy glass profitable. That's ridiculous. That is ridiculous. That is, it's such a classic case of a little bit of everyone's time everywhere just being casually disposed of because no single person is going to be angry enough about it to make it stop. This still won't stop it. This news has not resulted in Baltimore County being like, yeah, we're very sorry. Please stop recycling your glass. The policy remains unchanged. It's shocking. We should be angry. Recycling is garbage. The end.
Nick, what's a bit
literally
of news?
Garbage?
In this case, literally garbage. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Nick, what's a bit of news?
It's not a hidden story, but I think the complete fuck up in counting the Iowa caucus votes is one of the reasons why Trump, looks better by comparison, because the Democratic Party insists on putting a lot of stock into, you know, the Iowa caucuses, and, you know, with an incumbent, the Republicans don't have really anything to do there. But it's as I called it last, you know, before the caucuses, Iowa is a garbage state. The caucus system is garbage. They created an app that was a piece of crap. And so you get this weird outcome where nobody really understands what's going on, other than all of the Bernie bros and ladies are more pissed off than they ever were, which is saying something, because they did get robbed of a clear result that probably would have put their guy in first place.
I mean, It's a really revealing moment because Democrats are running. Yeah. They consistently run on managerial competence, on the idea that they can design systems that work. And then they designed this completely inscrutable, insane caucus system, combined it with a technology that they didn't test and that didn't work. And it completely blew up in their faces and just kind of reveals exactly how bad they are at running the sorts of systems that they are saying we need to implement nationally.
And this picks up on what Catherine is talking about, which is a smaller cut, but an important one, which is that you have the government, you know, or people effectively acting as government, telling you a story which gets revealed as bullshit. And then they're like, OK, well, let's just get on to the next thing. And it leads into the other thing that is actually happening tomorrow, which I think is great, is that Rand Paul is co-chairing hearings into the costs and benefits of the Afghanistan war based on the revelations in the Washington Post from last December. Hugely important. And that, to me, is the mega story of the past couple of months that really just kind of, you know, it was there for a second, you know, where the Washington Post had thousands of pages of documents that showed in detail how the American government started lying about Afghanistan and the possibilities of success, or even that we were pretending to have a definition of success for decades now. And, you know, this all adds up. And this is part of the reason why Trump is a viable politician now, because he kind of admits, you know, with a wink and a nod that he's crooked and that he's no different than the other people, other than he can make something out of it in a way. And he's not going to be apologetic.
We'll just add on to that, again, I found myself nodding most vigorously along at the Democratic debate. Elizabeth Warren, when talking about Afghanistan, I think she's very eloquent and I believe correct, although I could be wrong, that what we're doing there is pointless and we should stop and come home. Peter, what's a bit of news that wasn't covered very much over the past week that you think is nonetheless newsworthy or worth the attention of our dedicated and wonderful Reason Roundtable listeners?
On Thursday of last week, Attorney General William Barr, the top law enforcement official in the country, one of President Trump's biggest defenders, said that the U.S. government should consider taking, quote, a controlling stake in European countries Nokia and Ericsson in order to thwart Chinese 5G technology.
What?
He is basically saying that the government should own these companies, that it should own the means of production. And so in a presidential election year in which the Republican president is running totally reasonably in most ways against socialism and against possibly a self-declared socialist, you have a top Republican official actually proposing that the government quasi-nationalize an industry.
Speaking of socialists, I will choose as my story that didn't get a lot of coverage. It's got some. Was that a leading presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, said that he would legalize marijuana nationwide on day one of
day
his
one.
Presidency. Day one! It's going to legalize all of marijuana on day one, which I think is interesting in two ways that cut against each other. One is that it kind of just shows the fact that that wasn't newsworthy showed that, yes, it was a busy news week, but also favoring marijuana legalization is no longer either a career killer or even all that noteworthy anymore, which is a remarkable sign of progress. On the other hand, it's also super alarming that someone waving around, I'm just going to rewrite existing laws. I mean, with a pen and a phone, there's laws on the book. There's like a law that has to do the control of substance as a law. You can't just make it go away.
What is it, Matt?
This law, that's a law.
There is some ambiguity about the scheduling of marijuana and whether or not the president can kind of unilaterally dictate
and
that
that's
or
all
not.
And we've written about that a lot, and I think that would be great for the president to aggressively lead to the rescheduling, and he or she can and should do that. Legalizing it nationwide, just sort of a flippant attitude towards executive power, and sadly one that is absolutely mirrored by pretty much everybody in the and with any standing left left in the Democratic race. Just everyone's out competing one another with all the crazy stuff they're going to do in the first 100 minutes of the presidency. Okay, we've come to our last 100 minutes of this podcast, which means a discussion of what we all have been consuming. I presume that some of us were consuming at least parts of the Academy Awards last night. So I want to go first in just talking and defending Joaquin Phoenix's absolutely crazy speech. Like bookend that with Trump's victory lap in the White House. Like America's in a great place right now. What I liked about it was that it was actually vulnerable and weird and crazy. He's a haunted dude. He's coloring really far outside the lines. He was talking all kinds of stuff about like inseminating cows and stealing their babies and their cries of anguish. I kind of just loved it. Not that I agreed with a lot of it, although I did agree with a part that didn't get a lot of play, I don't think, which is that he went against cancel culture at the end and talked about the necessity for redemption and compassion and empathy and giving people second chances, all of which I think are messages that America needs to hear, if not necessarily in a 4-minute, absolutely rambling, crazy speech by a Best Actor nominee.
Well, that was also part of the opening, non-opening monologue by Chris Rock and Steve Martin, who started the show by saying, "Why isn't there a host? Twitter."
Twitter. Anyone else have an Oscar-related one to attack onto that? Catherine, I presume you're watching some of the dresses and the ladies.
Yeah, I definitely watched 0 minutes, but as always, went online and looked at these slideshows of the dresses, not just on the ladies.
That's true. Billy Porter,
as always, dominating the fashion headlines with a totally cuckoo bananas outfit that was beautiful and awesome. And I continue to be happy that we live in District 1 of Pan Am. The Hunger Games are going great for us, and the rise of multicolored hair and eyelashes that are actually feathers and hats that have pulleys on them, and now apparently a giant skirt modeled after Buckingham Palace's ceiling or something. Yes to all of it, but mostly yes to Janelle Monáe coming dressed, as always, as a sexy bisexual robot from the future. Never don't do that.
She's the greatest.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
Sometime in the last 2 weeks, I went to see Parasite, which ended up winning Best Picture, as well as, I guess, Best Foreign Language Picture. And it's phenomenal. I know you and Peter, I think, have talked about that in the past. It's a great movie. And it was, I think, you know, in the end, I could give two shits about who wins an Oscar and who doesn't. But it's a really good picture, and I'm kind of happy to see a picture like that, which is about ideas, and it's about class, and it's about hierarchy. It takes home the statue over a kind of the 90th iteration of something about World War I. I think we're past the age of epic, you know, historical epic, and it's much more interesting to see a movie like Parasite. I think it's a really, really great film. And it's similar in a way to Get Out or Us, the Jordan Peele movies that kind of play with genre as well as serious ideas. So I really, really
I liked it that you just called it a picture, like super grandpa style. Like we should be using that partially because of the concept of like, what's a movie, what's a film, what's a show is all broken down.
Who cares?
You have to say in an old man voice, like, I went to the pictures. Like that.
Speaking of which, my complaint about the Oscars is that the greatest orator of the word picture, Robert Evans, who died, was part of the in memoriam thing. And the in memoriam thing, they coupled people up. Like, let us have our crying on the couch moment with the individuals, not like have it like a confusion of two people. Suderman, what did you consume?
Well, I consumed the entire Oscars, and in particular, I consumed Parasite director Bong Joon-ho's great, great acceptance speeches, all of which were translated from Korean. The only things that he said in English were basically, Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino are great. Love those guys. Now I'm going to get really drunk.
Yeah.
And you know
over
what?
Over and over again.
You know what?
That's the
same.
A big mood, as the kids say.
Again, foregrounding the fact that none of this really matters, I was happy to see Martin Scorsese and The Irishman get shut out effectively, because it really was not a meaningful movie in any way, shape, or form. And if, you know, if Martin Scorsese has to move aside so Parasite and other movies like that can rise, it's a great movie.
I just like that Nick always wants to have an Irishman fight on these podcasts.
Yeah, he's just every day. He's like, let's pick another
It's a French goodbye. It's like
I strongly disagree about the Irishman, as you know, but I really loved Parasite. And in particular, I just want to put in a word for the movie as not as a great piece of social cultural filmmaking, even political filmmaking. And it's been adopted by a lot of people who are like, oh, this is a movie for our times because it's about inequality and social class. And it's basically the Bernie Sanders message in movie form. And I think that's a really shallow and kind of inadequate way of reading the movie. It's actually an incredibly humane film about social structures and about the invisible systems that sort of surround all of us and the ways that that we kind of don't know what systems we are enacting and we are trapped in. And it's a movie that isn't just sort of like rich people are bad and terrible. It's actually really quite empathetic towards its rich people, and it's a movie that is also just sort of really it's sad in a lot of ways, but it's also really just delightfully vicious in the way it kind of attacks everyone and everything and just sort of suggests that the only way out of our broken systems isn't, you know, to have, there isn't like, it's not like elect Bernie Sanders or pass campaign finance reform. It's like blow up the whole thing and end these systems, right? And just sort of like find some way to completely destroy everything, and escape. And it's, so there's a real kind of there's a deep humanity in all of his films, even if he's coming from a sort of a place of, leftist class warfare. Right. He also directed Snowpiercer and some stuff like that, that I think is really resonates and is really wonderful to see in film, in that he's asking questions rather than just trying to supply answers.
I think I think you're too charitable towards the wealthier people in that scenario, Peter. But it's incredible to see a movie that is actually treating kind of ideas in a serious way. It's really good. It's great on a kind of superficial plot level, and it's fucking awesome when you start to think about it. And it's easier to deal with in America because it's set in Korea. I suspect that if that movie has probably been made about America many times, and we just fails to register with us because it's too close to home. But
I don't know. It reminded me the early, the 1980s John Carpenter films, which were all these great, just, brutal little genre films. But stuff like They Live and Escape from New York and The Thing, which were all very clearly social, political parables about their time, but are also just really enjoyable as movies about Kurt Russell, fighting off crazy monsters.
I don't think those rose to the level of seriousness in terms of what they were critiquing. But yeah, I agree, in the main on that. And again, Escape from New York doesn't get taken as seriously in America, partly because it is American. But
I would just counter that The Thing is actually along with Idiocracy, the big predictor of our current political moment. And I would also like to single out for Opprobrium, journalist Alec McGillis, who last night said, one thing I'm still trying to figure out about Parasite, why wasn't the great film about extreme income equality made in the country that suffers from it the most? By which he presumably meant the United States, which is such a dumb tweet that even James Fallows said, because that would be China in response. But anyways, that's all the red China baiting that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned next week. And also go to allofreason.com/podcasts to see all of our offerings, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays. That's it. Thank you. Hopefully the news will slow down and we'll all have fun. The end.